Are you sure you want to stay here? It looks creepy.
But Savannah, this is the House of Mystery. Let's see, the brochure says true crime, conspiracy, alternate history, all rooms right here in the house.
I don't know, which room is ours?
Yes, this may be our room. Oh, well, sorry, ma'am. Obviously, this is not our room.
Oh, here's our room. True crime.
You've entered the House of Mystery on WXEI, the talk of Crestview, Panama City, Pensacola, Florida, with your hosts Al Warren, Kev Thompson, and Julie Saffel, and The Conspiracy Countdown with Dr. Joe and Stephen David Lampley's Crime Commentary.
All right, everybody, and we are back in the House of Mystery. You're being joined by your host, Kevin Thompson, and my co-host,
Rob Shulsky.
Hey, everybody. Today, we are coming to you out of WXEI, the talk of Clearview, Florida. And joining us today, we've got a special guest, Michael Morford, who's one of our Zodiac specialists. Welcome to the show, Mike.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me on.
It's good to have you here.
So, Mike, you've got to tell us a little bit about your story. What brought you here? What got you interested in, well, to begin with, serial killers, and then you decided to specialize on Zodiac. What brought you to this point?
Well, I guess when I was a kid, you know, I was always interested in different mysteries, and, you know, the TV show Unsolved Mysteries was on when I was growing up, and I really got into that. And then I read a book on Zodiac during, you know, my high school years, and we were assigned a book report, and I chose to do it on that case, and that sort of started it all for me. I just got hooked on that case, and over the years, checked out a couple more books, and then, you know, once, you know, the online community started popping up, you know, I really got into that, and it took off from there.
So you were oh my gosh, you should have said that off air, because I actually share that with you. We were assigned a topic, and we had to do a research paper, and I chose serial killers, and that's really how I got introduced to Zodiac. I mean, it's absolutely fascinating. I don't mean to be jumping right to the end, but from my understanding, the Zodiac is still, to this very day, he's out there.
Yeah, he was never identified, and, you know, that's one of the lures of the case, is that this guy could write lots of letters to the press and have this big spree and then just vanish and somehow not be caught after all these years. And I think that's part of what adds to the lure of the case.
So, really, what is it about the Zodiac that, you know, impresses upon you this much?
I think it's, you know, the brazenness to write to newspapers and in his real handwriting, what I feel is his real handwriting anyways, write letters over and over, taking credit for different crimes, calling into the police after the attacks, sending pieces of victims' clothing, sending ciphered codes. I mean, it's hard not to take all that in and think that's a really fascinating case with lots of different twists and turns, and over the years people have their theories. It's just one of those cases that you really get lost in, and you hope to see that it's solved one day, but at this point, who knows, it could be past that time.
So, you know, you've got a really good point there, and let's move on that. Here we have a killer who, you know, would if I remember right, he would start by shooting victims. And then he would write to the San Francisco Chronicle saying, I did this, and as evidence, here's this, here's this, here's what you'll find at the crime scene. Why, you know, because you brought this up, why would he then later begin writing in cipher and insist at the same time that this be publicized to all of San Francisco?
I think that he wrote to them with the ciphers to appear more mysterious. You know, maybe he had read some books about the case, about cipher cases and ciphers in general, and thought it was, you know, pretty neat to write a letter like that and have the police try and figure it out. Almost like he was living in a fantasy world where he was some great villain and he would send them secret codes and see if they could stop him. And I think that's how it started, and I personally think that he wrote those letters to get attention for himself, and then when they published them, he saw that he had a voice that he didn't have probably in his everyday life, and he was able to get attention, and he was the talk of the town in San Francisco back then. You know, that was the heyday of the hippie movement. You know, that was a big place on the map. So for him to be terrorizing the San Francisco Bay Area at that time, he really got a lot of attention, and that was probably something that he craved. And I think after a while, the crimes themselves were secondary. The main motivation was the letter writing.
Well, when you say the letter writing, do you think it was his ego? I mean, it sounds like this guy had a fantastic ego, if it was a he, and I assume it was.
Yeah, he definitely had an ego, and I think more than that, he probably needed some attention. I think in his regular everyday life, he was probably not somebody that got a lot of attention, and to have this voice all of a sudden where he was important, where people were talking about him, I think he kept feeding that, you know, that ego, that need to be recognized with those letters, and they kept publishing them, and it worked for him. He stopped killing and just continued writing letters for several years.
Well, there also seems to be an element of him thinking he's more intelligent with these encrypted sort of letters, coded letters, and this cat and mouse game, as if he was superior to the police. Do you think that's true?
Yeah, I think he thought that going in, and he thought he might outsmart them, and then, you know, the first cipher that he mailed was solved by a high school teacher, and then he sent another cipher, you know, a couple more ciphers, actually, that haven't been solved. So he either stepped up his game as far as how difficult they were to solve, or he just sent them something that was totally unsolvable because, you know, people like the CIA and the FBI and all kinds of different analysts and computer systems have been fighting to try and break that last cipher that he sent, and that's never been solved.
And your approach to your book, I mean, how did you approach writing the book? What spin did you put on it? What perspective?
Well, so I host a true crime podcast called Criminology, and season one we just completed not too long ago, and it was about the Zodiac case. And we got the idea, how cool would it be to have the entire podcast converted to a book? And, you know, I had been approached previously about writing a book about the case, and I didn't really consider myself much of a writer. But then I realized after writing so much material for the podcast that I had, you know, a book essentially. So we talked with Wild Blue Press, and they do a lot of true crime publication, and it seemed like a really good fit. We had some good ideas, and we wanted to sort of bring the podcast to a new audience, if you will. You know, people that read books and are big readers that might not be into podcasts as much, this was a way that they could enjoy what we had presented on the podcast in a book format.
Well, this one man, Gary Stewart, claims that it was his father who was this killer, Zodiac killer. Did you ever come up with anyone you thought was most likely to be the killer?
Yeah, my favorite suspect is Ross Sullivan. He's somebody that's gotten a lot of attention recently. He was focused on A&E, did a series about the Zodiac case, and Ross Sullivan was one of the main suspects they talked about. I think he was a good suspect. But in the book, we tried it. We mentioned some suspects, but we don't try and force any of them on anybody. We just sort of mention them in passing and let people decide for themselves who their favorite suspect might be.
See, I'm one of those people that wants to know, like, who really was Jack the Ripper. And everyone comes up with all these different fascinating possibilities.
There's 50 of them.
Right. And also with the Zodiac Killer. And I thought maybe with your perspective, Mike, that you might, like narrow it down for us. And I mean, is there someone you think really did it, or do you just not want to
Like,
say, or?
well, if I had a guess, I'd say it was Ross Sullivan, without going into the entire Zodiac story because it's a long, complicated one. But Zodiac seems to have roots down in Riverside County in 1966, a few years before the Zodiac murder started. And in particular, his writing was traced to a library in Riverside, and Ross Sullivan worked in that library. And then later on, when we finally got a picture of him after digging for a couple of years, we found out that he looked identical to the Zodiac sketch. So it sort of snowballed from there, and that's how it sort of started with him. And again, that's my own personal thought. A lot of people like him as a suspect, some people do not. But that's what's great about this case. Everybody can have their own theory, their own suspect. There's been some fair suspects over the years. Arthur Lee Allen was the most famous suspect, but for different reasons, he's sort of ruled out. But we've had lots of people confessing, saying my uncle was the Zodiac, my father was the Zodiac. It seems like every year these claims are made, and then it passes, nothing comes of it, and then the next year somebody else is making the same claim. So there's no shortage of suspects. A lot of them are pretty good, and some of them are not so good.
Seems like there's more all the time. Well, the Stewart said it was his father, Earl Van Best Jr., who was his biological father. And he said he died in 1984, which would explain why we don't hear of the Zodiac Killer anymore. Do you think he's still alive?
I don't think the Zodiac's alive. I think whoever he is, has died by now. He would be, depending on the age range, on the early end, would probably be, late 60s. On the very early end, he could be in his 80s. So if he's alive, he's probably not too active. I wouldn't think he is, but I tend to think he died
No, I guess
because
it wouldn't be.
I think with some of the media coverage and books and movies and things that have come out, I think he wouldn't have been able to resist writing a letter and just reaching out. So I tend to think he's dead.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing. And the upshot of your book, I mean, how do you end your book? What's the summation of it?
Well, essentially, we go from start to finish with the case and just sort of a walk through from the beginning of where it starts and where it leaves off, which is essentially, 1974 when the letters stop. We do talk about some of the books and things that movies and whatnot that come after that, pop culture stuff. But essentially, for the case coverage, we ended in 1974, and that's when the letters stop from the Zodiac, because after that, everything is guessing, is theory. But everything between that time, from 1966, if you want to go back that far, essentially all of that is stuff we discuss all the way up from 1974 when the letters stop.
So
And you
what
see, oh, I'm sorry, go ahead, Kevin.
so what was his first killing?
Well, his first confirmed killing was in December of 1968 in the outskirts of Vallejo. But again, before that, down in Riverside in 1966, he's linked to some stuff there that's not officially confirmed. And that was the murder of a young girl named Sherry Jo Bates. And then going back as far as 1963 in Santa Barbara County, there's a double murder of a young couple down there that there's some evidence that links him possibly to that. But the first, official confirmed attack by Zodiac is in December of 1968.
And we were discussing this just before we went on the air, but I'd like to repeat it on the air. Your fascination with him in particular, is it because of his ego? Because, I mean, he didn't commit the most killings. I think John Wayne Gacy did, didn't he? And
And
so,
children.
yes.
Yeah, and it from a murder or serial killer standpoint, I should say, he doesn't have that many confirmed kills. He's got a handful of confirmed kills, and they're over a short period of time. There's a few others that he's speculated killing, but compared to a lot of serial killers, that's, a drop in the bucket for victim count. So it wasn't that made him as popular and well known as he is. It was the letter writing, I think, that he was sort of original with reaching out to the police and playing this cat and mouse game And they kept publishing his letters, and he kept sending more, and it was this open dialogue. And I think that sort of is for me anyway, is what adds to the lore of the case, is just that dialogue that he seemed to have that is very uncommon with most, you know, serial killers. Most serial killers don't want to get caught, and they're avoiding the police. Here, this guy's reaching out to them and giving them clues and having a dialogue with them. So that was pretty original, and that's one of the most fascinating things about the case.
It also sounds like the media played a big role in it, too, almost like not just a serial killer, but a serialized column in the newspapers and TV at the time is what you're basically saying, right?
Right? And the sensationalism.
Right.
Absolutely, because that was newsworthy for them, and that was selling newspapers for them. So the fact they opened that dialogue, people wanted to see what Zodiac was doing and saying and what the correspondence was, and I think that sold newspapers for them, and that's, you know, whether that's why they chose to have a dialogue with them in the first place, who knows? But, you know, from a business standpoint, it's probably smart because they did sell a lot of newspapers.
And also, it sounds like the police played a certain role in making this notorious by releasing all those letters. One would have thought they wouldn't, but so it's a bit of a surprise that they did.
Or at least do so on the advice of the police, because he also sent letters to the police as well.
Yeah, for the most part, he did. Right, he did send a ciphered code to the police. There's some possibility he down in Riverside he had sent stuff to the police. In San Francisco, in that area, for the most part, he was sending them to the newspapers. But the police chose. You know, the newspaper would turn them over to the police, and the police would chose. They chose which ones to release and which ones to not release. You know, trying to hold some stuff back. You know, not including certain details in some of the letters. But they did, I think part of the reason they released the letters to the public was because they were hoping to identify him through some of his writing. Because if you see those letters, you can Google them and find lots of images of them online. You know, to me, that looks like his everyday normal handwriting. I don't think he's disguising his handwriting. So I think the police probably had hoped to release that information and those letters, hoping that somebody might recognize it.
Well, could you tell us about some of the killings themselves? I'm kind of curious because it's been so long, I don't really remember much about the individual killings.
Well, so essentially what he would do is he would stalk people in lovers' lanes. You know, it'd be couples parked in their cars and out of the way, secluded areas. And, you know, he shot a couple couples in a row, you know, one in, again, in December of 1968 and then in July of 1969. And then from there, he went on to, you know, move over to Napa County, which is, you know, a county over, and he struck at Lake Berryessa, and this time he attacked a couple that was, you know, in the daytime, which was sort of unusual for him, and instead of shooting them, he stabbed them, which, you know, and then the final victim that he's known to have killed is Paul Stein, a cab driver he shot in San Francisco. And that was sort of a departure in that it was a different area. It was a lone male. Mm-hmm. So he sort of changed his MO slightly as he went along. But primarily he started out stalking vulnerable couples on lovers' lanes, you know, late at night.
Well, is that normal for them to change their modus operandi that extremely? I mean, gun to knife, different locations, different victims? That's not the normal serial killer style, is it?
Well, if they don't want to get caught right away.
Well, no, but I mean, serial killers always seem to go after a type. I mean, you know, they like young women, or they're going after young men, or they like couples, like the Zodiac Killer did to begin with. But usually they don't change in midstream. Isn't that unusual, or is it?
Yeah, I think for a lot of times, anyway, you see killers have a very specific MO. They target the same kinds of people with the same kind of weapon. And again, for the most part, he did use a gun in just about all his crimes. In fact, when he stabbed the couple, he had a gun with him, and one of them survived, and he was able to relay to police that he did use a gun to calm them down and subdue them and tie them up, and then he pulled out a knife and stabbed them. So for the most part, it was, you know, a gun. And if you go back to the Riverside case in 1966, the girl that he's associated with down there, Sergio Bates, she was stabbed to death. So there's this little intersecting of knife versus gun. But primarily, he does target vulnerable people that are alone or sort of in secluded areas. So that part of the MO, you know, holds true.
And I'm trying to grasp this here.
Well, while you do that, let's go here real quick. Each type of a killing, if I remember my psychology right, each type of killing represents something about the killer themselves. For example, gunshots. I don't want to be that close to the person. Knife attacks is something personal. And then you have rage attacks, which is multiple. What changed about the Zodiac that he changed his method of killing?
Also his victims, his targets. Wouldn't that be psychological too?
Yeah, and it seemed like, you know, he definitely attacked both the men and the women that he encountered, but it seemed like the women he spent a little bit more time attacking, and most often they died, whereas, you know, a few different males survived. And it seemed like he was, you know, he wasn't strangling people, he wasn't getting up very close to them. He liked to walk up, blitz attack, shoot, and then leave. Whereas that Lake Berryessa one in Napa County, that was more personal. You know, stabbing somebody is more personal. You've got to get close to them. And you know, that's where his MO slightly changed. Although, again, he did have a gun with him, so he probably was prepared to use a gun if he needed to. And, you know, we could speculate as to why he did that, but we just don't know. He could have had a fantasy about stabbing somebody, or if he was connected to the Sherry Joe Bates case back in 1966, maybe he wanted to relive that. You know, there's all kinds of possibilities about why he chose to use that attack with a knife.
Did he use the knife, different knives and different guns, or did they, because I don't remember that.
I'm sorry, he did use different guns in his crimes. You know, he used different handguns. And the one time that we know he used a knife, he used a bayonet-style, long-bladed bread knife, you know, if you can picture that kind of knife. That's what he used to stab them with. But in the shooting incident, he did use different handguns. And back in the 1963 case that he think he may be, you know, law enforcement, think he may have been connected to, he used a rifle in that incident.
Okay, so he changed his modus operandi, he changed his victim type. Do you think his motivations changed as well, his motives?
Yeah, I mean, motivation-wise, I think towards the end when he killed Paul Stein, the cab driver, he was striking in a new area. It was in the heart of San Francisco. It was a lone male. It wasn't vulnerable couples. I think he was trying to switch up his MO, maybe throw off the police a little bit. But then, again, I think his MO shifted away from killing people. I think the killing was done to get some kind of attention. But then he realized he could get the attention with the letter writing and not even have to kill people. So I think as you see that go along, you know, you see those attacks stop, but the letter writing just continues. And the threat of killing other people is what he's enjoying. He likes the attention for making the threats to kill other people.
So you don't think it was about power over the victim or any kind of a sexual kind of urge or anything as it is with some of them?
I think he got probably some kind of sexual satisfaction. I think they're tied together. You know, whether he even knew it or not, I think that gave him some kind of pleasure, no doubt. But I think what outweighed that, what he got the most pleasure from, was getting the attention that the letters to the newspapers gave him. And he enjoyed that, and he kept writing and kept trying to outdo his letters each time with fancier letters. So I think that became his driving motivation.
So you think it was notoriety, basically, that drove him principally?
Yeah, that's what I think it wound up being. Even if it didn't start out that way, I think that's sort of where it led him to, and that's where he got the most satisfaction out of.
Well, here's a theory. How about this, guys? That actually, in the beginning, he was actually looking for women and was prepared, as Mike suggests, for a male with a gun, but he meant to attack the women with a knife and just happened to run into the men. So it became a double murder.
Well, how does that explain the taxi driver, though?
Yeah, it's possible, but if you look at his first two texts, there's no evidence of him using a knife at all. It's just simply walking up to the car. You know, the first case, the people got out of the car, so he either ordered them out or they ran to get out of the car, one of the two, and he shot both of them and killed them. No evidence of a knife used in that crime. And in the second shooting, he walked up, came alongside the door, and just opened fire. There was never any kind of interaction, no talking to the female, no trying to get her out, no showing a knife. It was just a blitz-style attack, just shooting. And then he walked away and started to get in his car, and he actually came back and shot some more. So he could have, if he wanted to use a knife, he could have taken a knife out after that and started using it, but he never did. He only used the knife that one time that we know of with certainty.
What do you think made him stop?
You know, I think I think he really didn't want to get caught, because after his last, you know, attack on Paul Stein, the cab driver, he was witnessed, you know, walking away from the crime scene. He left a bloody print on the cab at the crime scene. And that infamous Zodiac sketch, that if you Google Zodiac, you see this sketch of side-by-side, you know, composites of him.
I remember it, yeah.
Yeah, I think that scared him, and he was just seconds away from being caught, because as soon as he walked around the corner, police were on the scene. It was very fast. And there's some indication that he was witnessed by, you know, police officers on the scene that night as they were patrolling the area as he was making his escape. So I think he realized that he probably came very close to getting caught, and I think he just didn't want to go to jail, and I think that's why he stopped.
But serial killers, I thought, were like under compulsion. They couldn't help themselves. So periodically, they had to do it, and over time, it begins to speed up, and they have to do it more and more often. So he could just turn it on at some point in his life and then switch it off like that, you think?
Well, I think we see in a lot of cases, some of these guys can end for stretches of time. You know, if you look at somebody like BTK, he stopped for several years. If you look at the Golden State Killer, there's a 5-year hiatus where he doesn't kill anybody, and then all of a sudden he does. So there is right, there are instances right. where serial killers do stop for periods of time,
them and tie them but up, not forever.
Ordered them out, or they ran. Well, he could have died. He could have went to jail, and he shot maybe whatever. He doesn't kill anybody. Illness he was dealing with, maybe it subsided, or he could be in a mental institution. There's any number of different ideas and theories of what stopped him.
Well, here's the theory. Maybe he thought they were too close. What with the palm print and everything, maybe he committed suicide.
That's definitely possible. That's one thing that some you know, different psychiatrists and profilers and stuff thought, that suicide was a possibility for him due to the mental illness that they thought he might be suffering, and they thought that was one possibility. So any number of suicides
in California
during that time, one of those could have been his.
Anyone like off the San Francisco Bridge or something. I have one more question on this subject. What do you think triggered it in the first place for him to start? I mean,
what was the trigger again?
Yeah.
You know, it's hard to say. You know, if you go down to Riverside, I really think Riverside he was involved in, if not the murder itself in 1966, it was possibly the victim. You know, the victim was stabbed outside the library, and it got a lot of attention, and the police, you know, were investigating everybody there, and I think it was such a sensational story right at that time that I think he may have been inspired by that to start, you know, whatever things he was already thinking in his head. I think that's what drove him to start his crime spree, because the letters in the murder of Sherry Joe Bates are attributed to Zodiac, but there's no physical evidence that he killed her. So it's possible that a different killer had killed Sherry Joe Bates, but he sent letters in her case. And so he might have started off just taking credit for her murder, writing letters in her case, but had not actually killed anybody at that point.
So your theory of notoriety is supported by that. I mean, that's a good reason for him to start. If it's notoriety, and then he sees someone else getting notorious coverage, that he would want to do likewise and get the same.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's interesting.
So given your research, I've got to ask this because it's nagging at me. Given your research, what is your psychological profile of the killer and of the victims themselves?
Well, I think the victims, I'll start with them first. They were easy to find. They were, you know, back in the 60s, if you wanted some privacy, you go out with your, you know, a guy and a girl would go out to park on a secluded area and do some necking or whatever they called it back then, and they'd have their privacy, it'd be quiet. And I think he knew that. I think he knew he could find those people in those areas. There'd be little, as far as witnesses, there'd be, you know, a lot better chance of him being able to successfully do what he wanted to do. And I think probably, profile-wise, I think he probably was somebody that didn't have a connection with somebody, that never had the opportunity to go out and park with, you know, a significant other in an area like that. So I think he sort of coveted that. And I think that's why he chose to strike those areas. It was a combination of finding easy victims there, and maybe he was sort of jealous of what they were doing that he couldn't do. And I think, you know, you're probably dealing with somebody that's on the edge of society, somebody that's, you know, a lower, you know, blue-collar, lower-class person that didn't have anything really going on in their life. You know, that's my own personal profile of who he was. You know, there's other people out there that think he was a wealthy businessman that was just doing this for fun. I don't think that at all. But, you know, that's the thing with this case. There's no right or wrong in a theory because until he's identified, you know, anybody could be right.
It, again, though, that almost sounds like sexual frustration. He's starting out with couples on Lover's Lane.
Good points.
Yeah, and that's, again, that's probably something that he didn't have. He didn't have somebody to go out there in a lover's lane with. He was probably lonely, probably rejected by women, probably didn't do well dating. So that's something that he resented. So, you know, it was a perfect combination of finding easy victims, but also they were the people that he sort of coveted and resented the activity they were having. So I think that was a good target for him.
So it's almost like a perverted sexuality in a way, after all, because he couldn't have it, couldn't get it kind of thing, relationship or anything. And I meant relationship. And yeah. And so he basically went for the satisfaction of notoriety instead.
Yeah, that's my own opinion. I think that's how he started and what drove him. And I think the loneliness that he was experiencing and the lack of attention that he got in his everyday life, he was able to get, you know, onto the Zodiac persona. I think that's, you know, he took that as far as he could as far as writing letters and stuff.
Any guesses as to how old he might have been approximately when he started this?
You know, I would guess he was probably in his, you know, there were instances where people talked to him on the phone when he called after his attack. And they said he sounded young, you know, like possibly in his 20s. In the later descriptions of him, you know, they put out one sketch and estimated his age at 25 to 35. Then they put out another sketch estimating it at 35 to 45. So it's sort of all over the place. He sounded younger, but he looked as old as 45. So it's hard to eliminate a good, you know, suspect pool because his age is so broad.
The range,
and not just that, but a lot of guys had that look with those eyeglasses and the crew cuts back then. So, you know, that fit a lot of different people back then, unfortunately.
Yeah, everyone who worked for the FBI included.
Now, there were some killings, and this is confusing, and this kind of lends into the multiple killer theory. Like you just described, some witnesses describe a man with glasses and a crew cut. And personally, I take offense to that, but that's a whole other show. But then you have a killer that is wearing a very particularly styled mask with the crosshairs on it. You know, why the bounce around?
Well, at night, when he attacked, you know, in one of the nighttime attacks, you know, the victims didn't survive, so we don't know what they saw. And the other one that we saw, you know, in July of 1969, there was a survivor, and he described the guy walking up dressed normally. not having a mask on, but he did have a flashlight in his eye, so he couldn't see too well, but he didn't see any kind of mask or anything. The difference in the one where he wore the mask was it was during the daytime, it was daylight hours, and that was a time when Zodiac didn't usually strike. So I think the mask could have been done to number one, protect his identity should something go wrong and he, you know, have to get run away or whatever. But I think the second reason was to terrorize the people that he was, you know, going after. You know, you see this sinister guy coming toward you in this executioner's mask, essentially is what it looked like. You know, the people are going to be pretty scared. So that's part of the reason I think he probably donned that hood. And then after that, he went back to killing at night, where he was described as not having a mask again. So he only used that hooded mask one time that we know of.
So one has to ask, and I'm kind of leaning towards a listener question here whenever we told them that you'd be on. If Zodiac was alive, how would you picture him today? This is a man that got away with killings from the 60s, 70s, you know, and even took credit for a couple in the 80s. Where would he be today, or what do you imagine him as today?
You know, I'd have a hard time believing he was married or had a family. You know, you hear about killers who are arrested and they've been living this life for the last 30 years with their grandkids. I don't see this guy as getting married. I think he probably didn't do well with the women. So I think he probably never got married. And I think he probably died, you know, someplace at some point, single and not much to his name. And, you know, the hope with law enforcement and with Zodiac researchers like myself is that there's going to be this treasure trove of material and weapons and confessions found in his belongings after he died, but that's never happened. So I think at this point it's most likely that the case is just never going to be solved, and the guy is going to, you know, turn out to be like, you know, Jack the Ripper, possibly never known for sure who he was.
And so if he's dead, that could have been the reason that he stopped. Or the other thing is that he could have thought the police were coming after him, so that's the reason he stopped. Any kind of a third idea there? Any theories?
No, I mean, those are the two most you know, logical ones, I would think, is fear of being caught, not wanting to go to jail, but again, illness, a terrible injury of some sort that kept him from doing stuff, that kind of stuff, suicide, death, any of those things could have been what stopped him, you know. Or, again, it's rare, a lot of serial killers don't stop, but you see somebody like BTK that stops for that long a time, so maybe somehow he was just able to stop and then live a normal life after that. I tend to doubt that, but, you know, it's just so many possibilities. That's what makes this case mind-boggling.
I find it intriguing. So in your book, when you summed it up, I mean, did you come to any conclusions of your own that you dared state? Because I haven't read your book, but now I'm going to.
Yeah. So the book is a pre-order. It'll be out hopefully, I think, May is when we're shooting for that. It'll actually be on the shelf. But what we do is we lay out the case in a neutral format, so it's not so much our opinions on stuff. We're laying out the case as the facts happened, as the incidents occurred, and just sort of doing an overlay of the case so people can get a full understanding of what happened and how it happened, and it goes in chronological order so they can follow along, and we try to leave the case at the end of it where the listener makes their own determination of what happened. And that's, the book's going to, you know, reflect the podcast to where at the end of it, you'll have all the material and you'll be able to come to your own conclusions.
Well, that's cool. And I often do that with my own books as well. But I have to be honest with you, when it comes to these murder scenarios, like with the Jack the Ripper, I've watched show after show on that, and they keep coming up with a different person. And they make it all sound so convincing for each person that when the show ends, I think, oh, yeah, that's got to be the person. Then I watch another show, and I think, oh, yeah, that's got to be the person.
And that's what's with the unsolved cases like this, you know, the person that's interested in solving, the armchair detectives, can sort of all hunt along and come up with their own suspects, and until they're proven wrong, you know, any of their theories could be right, and that's the lure of the case, that you can, you know, try and solve it. But unless the case is solved, we're not going to really know, who's right.
No,
no, but you want to.
I've already solved it because I've watched every season of Criminal Minds.
It was probably your father, right?
Well, it is Alabama.
You have inside information, right?
I have high-level sources, as Alex would say.
So, Mike, what's next for you? Are you going to do more books like these?
Well, our current season of Criminology is out, and season two, and we're covering the Golden State Killer, which is an infamous serial killer and rapist in California. He was active for 10 years, and he's got, you know, 50 rapes and a dozen murders to his credit, you know, way more than Zodiac. And the funny thing is, a lot of people in California hadn't even heard of this guy, but they've heard of Zodiac. You know,
I'll be honest, I haven't heard of him either, and I used to live in California, lived in San Diego. So, yeah, it's intriguing. And do you have any specific serial killer you would like to write about? I mean, one that you've always had this burning desire besides the Zodiac killer?
Well, the Zodiac was the first season that I wrote. You know, we wrote that, and that was a way to get that out of our systems. There's a good chance that we're going to write about this Golden State Killer that we're doing now, and possibly put a book out after this season wraps up. But there's a lot of different cases. The Colonial Parkway murders is one that I've always been interested in.
One in Hollywood, too, wasn't there? The Hollywood serial killer,
Black Dahlia?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. That dates back, too, but that's an incredible one. I watched a couple different movies on that, and it always intrigues me. Pretty horrific. No, I was thinking of the one where the two guys, apparently, they finally got them, didn't they? You would know better than I would.
Oh, I think you're talking about the Hillside Stranglers.
That's the one, yes. That's
Hillside Stranglers. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, it seems like California has more than its share of, you know, serial killers to talk about. You know, you got the Night Stalker, Richard Ramirez, you've got the vampire killer, Richard Chase. It's just no shortage there. But I sort of like to move around the country and look at different areas, different crimes. So, you know, in the future, I'm hoping that, you know, there'll be some other cases that intrigue me enough to draw me in and possibly write about.
Well, as a side note, I just heard recently that Cincinnati is the serial capital of the country, that more serial killers per capita have occurred in Cincinnati than in any other city in the country, which I thought was, that's what I
Cincinnati,
was
Cincinnati, Ohio.
Yes, isn't that strange? Yeah.
Of all places.
Of all places, state. City, on, as far as the city goes, not the state, the city. Yeah.
It's interesting. I would have thought for sure it would have been someplace in California. It seems
like Los Angeles, Hollywood. I mean,
yeah,
or San Francisco. Yeah,
with Weinstein and all.
That's another case. That's another episode there. All by itself.
I think Kevin's murdering the show. Well, if you had to concentrate on one particular state, which state would you pick? California.
If I live in New Jersey, so California, you know, all the cases I seem to be drawn to are in California, but unfortunately I live on the other side of the country, which is probably a good thing, because my wife probably would have divorced me by now, because I'd be out investigating and researching like 24 hours a day. But I do like the idea of being able to look at some stuff closer to home. I look at some different cases in Pennsylvania that I like.
Check out Cincinnati.
But I sort of move around, and luckily with the internet and with books and stuff, I'm able to learn about different cases that I'm interested in all over the country. So I sort of gravitate to different cases here and there all over the place.
Well, pardon my ignorance here, but you keep saying we when you're talking about these books, so I take it these are collaborative efforts?
Yeah, so, you know, my co-host on the podcast and co-author of the book is Mike Ferguson. So we did the podcast together, and the book is the result of the podcast.
And your wife doesn't take part in it at all?
No, just for moral support. And
don't underestimate that.
No, it's definitely a value. I've got the greatest wife, you know, I can ask for, and she's very supportive of the true crime stuff that I work on. So, you know, I'm very lucky from that standpoint.
It sounds like you are. Of course, we are on air, so you kind of would have to say that, wouldn't you?
I honestly do think it, though. So.
Okay.
So, any television in your future, Mike?
Well, I did an appearance on the ID Network. Just had a Golden State Killer special called Golden State Killer, It's Not Over. It was a multi-night episode that appeared just last week. I think it was on the 5th is when it aired, 5th and 6th. So I appeared in that, and I actually did some consulting for the Zodiac show that was on the History Channel.
Impressive.
So I have worked a little bit with TV. I definitely would like to work some more with it, you know, whether it's behind the scenes or in front of the camera or whatever. So I'm always open to different projects like that if they come along and the opportunity is right. I definitely wouldn't rule it out. So that's always a possibility.
And how would people get a hold of you? I mean, how could they contact you? Are your books available or the book available for pre-order yet or any of that sort of
yeah,
thing?
Yeah, so if they wanted to look at the book or learn more about it, they can always go to Wild Blue Press and they can go to wildbluepress.com/Zodiac pre-orders. And once they go there, there'll be a little page set up and they can learn a little bit about the case, what the book is about. They can do a pre-order if they want. And I'm very active on social media. You know, they can always, you know, find me on my podcast, social media at Twitter, which is Criminology Pod. Or I have my own Twitter handle for all true crime stuff, which is True Crime Guy at True Crime Guy on Twitter.
How about a website where people could go and check out?
Yeah, I have truecrimeguy.com.
Oh, that's easy.
Yeah.
I'll remember
true
one.
Crime guy.
Yeah, that's a good one, yeah.
Yeah, I was surprised it was available, but I liked the sound of it, and it was available, so I got it.
Yeah, I wish I'd gotten something like that. Instead, I got a really long one. No one's going to ever remember it.
So your latest book, Golden State Killer. Tell us about that.
So we're just in the middle of the season, you know, of the podcast on the Golden State Killer. So we're hoping that, and it's most likely that we will do the same thing, a book about the Golden State Killer based on the podcast. And the podcast to book is going to be a series, essentially, where each case we cover. As it's converted to a book, it'll be part of an ongoing series. So we think that's pretty neat. Like the Zodiac book is called Criminology True Crime Podcast Presents the Case of the Zodiac Killer. So for the Golden State Killer books, should we do that, it would be Criminology True Crime Podcast Presents the Case of the Golden State Killer. So that would probably come out down the road a ways. We're looking at wrapping up the season on the case probably in June. So some point after that, we would probably expect to have a Golden State book coming out after that.
One quick question. Would it be better to have the book out before the podcast so people could read it and listen to the podcast at the same time, like a synergistic thing, or do you think it's better to have the book come out after the podcast?
I actually like the book after the podcast, excuse me, because I think there's some things that we can put in the book that we can't put on a podcast, you know, as far as photos and
Ah, yeah. Well, that's what I was wondering, why the two together might not be cool, because as they're listening, they could be, you know, reading along in the book at the same time. But yeah, I see your point. And after the fact, it's sort of a compilation, and then everything's available all at once.
Yeah, and it's sort of, you know, it sort of allows you to get the audio version of it and then go back afterwards. Because again, we deal with these over, you know, sometimes 12 episodes, so 12, you know, weekly episodes of listening to it and soaking it in, and then you can go back after that and get the book and brush up on some of the stuff you might have missed in the podcast. Plus, we have additional information in there, things that we didn't necessarily include in the podcast that we'll be able to get in the book as well.
Yeah, because you can't absorb it all at once. You know, it takes time.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
All right. Well, Mike, I appreciate you being on with us today here on the House of Mystery.
I appreciate you guys having me on. It was a great conversation. I love the show.
I thought it was great.
Absolutely. Now, one more time, before we let you go, what is your contact information in case anybody believes that maybe they have something that's relevant to your research or relevant to your appearances or your writings?
The easiest way is go to truecrimeguy.com, mm-hmm. and then on the right side of the page, there's a contact form, and you can just put your information in there, put your name in there, and I'll get the contact, and I'm pretty good about getting back to people, so I can usually get back to people, you know, within a day or so.
Yeah, it might be a great source of information for you, actually, huh?
Oh, yeah, I mean, and I've gotten leads and tips and things before that I've passed along, so if somebody has some information, you know, I'd be glad to look at it and send it to the appropriate agency.
And do you assure anonymity?
Yeah, if they want to do that, too, if they want to sort of remain anonymous, I'm happy to do that.
Now, we've got about 1 minute left with you, and I've got to ask this. It just dawned on me. What would you do if you got a letter in cipher from Zodiac himself?
I've actually, you know, hoped, you know, that I would get one in the mail. I thought that would be pretty neat. Yeah, I just think that would be something that would be a neat story. I mean, I'm not worried about him because, I think he's dead. But if I got a letter in the mail from him, it would just be sort of a weird souvenir. But additionally, hopefully, it would provide some clues. You know, I'd obviously turn it over to law enforcement, and then, you know, maybe there's something in there that they are able to track him down with. But, you know, that never happens. So, you know, at this point, who knows?
I mean, we keep saying that he's too old now. You know, he'd be dead. But, I mean, word has it that Hitler's alive in Antarctica.
Yeah, but he's probably in a nursing home by now.
Never know. If he's out there listening to this, send me a letter.
Awesome. Well, everybody, we've been joined today by one of our premier Zodiac specialists. And again, Michael, we thank you. Thank you for being on with us today.
Incredible show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on, guys.
Awesome. Well, everybody, you've been listening to the House of Mystery. And we hope you'll join us again for more exciting guests. Today, you've been hosted by Kevin Thompson and
Rob Shulsky. Did I do that right?
You did. Awesome. Everybody, we'll talk to you again soon.
Welcome to Stephen's True Crime Commentary. Discussions of forensics, how it's done, and true crime interest.
Hello, welcome back to Stephen's True Crime Commentary, and I am Stephen David Lampley. Welcome. Did you know that all, and I said all, of the world's digital information that is currently available in all forms could be stored on just 2 grams of human DNA. Today we're going to talk about DNA, and I'm going to try to make it interesting because I'll be honest, to me DNA is a pretty boring subject. It does have some amazing applications in crime and forensics. This is the first part of a series on DNA. Alright, just stay with me on this. Some of you are probably thinking DNA, yawn, yawn, yawn. I'm going to listen to something else and I'll come back after the DNA segment's over. I get that, okay? I'm going to try to make it interesting. I'm trying to give you some facts and some trivia about DNA that's going to make it more interesting. DNA is really a good crime-solving tool. All right, what is DNA? DNA, the name for DNA is deoxyribonucleic acid. Okay, there'll be a test after this, so make sure you take notes. I'm just kidding. All right, DNA is a thread-like, ladder-looking chain that's responsible for carrying the genetic instructions for a variety of functions, such as basic functioning, the development, growth, and reproduction of organisms, and even some viruses. DNA is a powerful, powerful tool. Simply put, though, DNA is the hereditary material in organisms. Did you know that humans share 50% of their DNA with bananas? All right, so next time you're in the store, walk over to the banana section, wave, and say, "Hey, cuz, do humans share 50% of their DNA with bananas?" Try finding them on your family tree, okay? Okay, now this thread-like material that is found in each cell, the DNA that's found in each cell, if it was straightened out and laid end to end, it would measure approximately, listen carefully, it would measure approximately 10 billion miles. Go look it up if you don't believe me, okay? 10 billion miles. That's enough to go to Pluto and come back home again. Each DNA strand is approximately 1.8 meters long, and it's compacted into a space, folks, that's 9/100ths of a micrometer. We're talking some really amazing facts here. DNA is located in the part of the cell called the nucleus, and the nucleus is basically the brain of the cell. Now, this packaged form of DNA is often referred to as a chromosome. All right, now let's talk about genome for a moment, and then we're going to end up, and we'll come back next time and then continue on with DNA. Genome. What in the crap is a genome? A genome is a person's total genetic material. It's everything that is involved in genetics. That's a person's genome. Right? A person's genome is so expansive that it would take a person 50 years working 8 hours a day, typing 60 words a minute, to type out the entire human genome. So when we talk about DNA, we're talking about something that's miraculous. All right, our time is up today. We will come back next time and continue our discussion on DNA, and I'm going to try to give you some more information. We're going to actually get through basically telling you what DNA is so that when we get on to the forensics part, you'll understand it. We're going to talk about the forensics parts of that as far as crime and court. So it's been a pleasure being with you again. I look forward to having you back next time.
Thank you for tuning in to Stephen's True Crime Commentary, and we welcome you to check out Stephen's book, Outside Your Door, a collection of true crime stories right from Stephen's case file and street experience. You want true crime? Let Stephen take you to the streets with him. It doesn't get much more real than from the officer and undercover SVU detective himself. 5-star rated with Amazon, Barnes, and Noble, and Books a Million. Real cases. Real stories. Real people. Outside Your Door, by Stephen David Lampley.
Stephen's True Crime Commentary is a production of Something Weird Media and West 53rd Productions, with music by JasonLampley.com.
To find out more about our show, guests, or listen to a previous show, visit our website at www.somethingweirdmedia.com.
have been completed.
The end!
By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll see you.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.